Welcome to the Lovecraft Show, everybody. My name's Mr. X-Ditch.
And I'm Marion.
And we're glad to be back in your lug holes. I hope you're all keeping well. I hope you've enjoyed the episodes that have come out so far. We're looking forward to today's show, aren't we, Marion?
We really are. And the guest we have today is one of the luminaries of the knitting world.
Yes, they say she's the editor of the second coolest craft magazine that's out there. I might be the first.
We're going to talk today to Nora Gawne. She is the editor of Vogue Knitting magazine. She's an incredible knitwear designer. She was so interesting to talk to, wasn't she, Jamie?
Yeah, it was a really fascinating interview. It was interesting for me because, like I say, she's an editor of the mag. I'm an editor of the mag. I thought that was interesting. But also how she got there and her own like personal creative path and stuff like that. So
yeah, super, super interesting. We loved this interview.
And we think you'll love it too. So let's just crack on. I've got a mate who, unbeknownst to me, has started drinking brake fluid. And I'm like, mate, that is really dangerous. What are you doing? But he assures me that he can stop at any time. Hey, everybody, it's the Lovecraft Show.
Boom, boom.
Hello, Jamie. Welcome to the Lovecraft Show. We are thrilled today because joining us, we have the amazing Nora Gawne, knitwear designer, magazine editor. The accolades could go on and on and on, Nora. There's so many things that you've done.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
That's great. Well, we've got all sorts of things to ask you about today. But really, I suppose, because we love to chat to people on the show about their sort of their crafting beginnings and how did it start for you? Did the love of yarn start early or design? Or I know that your parents were very artistic.
Yes.
Do you think that's where it came? That's where it comes from?
Well, my parents were both professional artists, but also my mom crocheted and sewed. And my grandmother, who lived with us, mom's mom, embroidered and hand sewed and crocheted as well. So really, I think from the women in the household is where most of it comes from. I mean, the artistic part, I can say, came from both sides of the family.
Was it something that was a chord like throughout your younger years, or was it something you kind of picked up as an adult? Because I mean, I know you went and did like science and art at uni and those sorts of things, biochemistry and stuff. So
no, I didn't do that. Wikipedia is wrong. So I have a degree in biology and art.
Biology and art.
But the Wikipedia thing, I think, is still wrong. It says biochemistry, and that was never true. Never true. But it really started when I was a kid. So I learned how to crochet when I don't really remember, but maybe 7 or 8. And I went crazy with that, like made up vests. Because that was the time when those granny square vests were, you know, at their height. So I could go crazy and make stuff up. I remember sewing in zippers when things didn't stretch. And maybe because of my mom being inventive, I didn't think anything of like making stuff up. So then by the time I learned how to knit, which was when I was 14, it seemed pretty natural to make things up from there too. But I tell this story a lot. It is crucial to my designing beginnings is that when I learned how to knit, a good friend of mine taught me, and I came home and I bought yarn at the county fair. And I was going to do a sweater out of a magazine, which I did eventually do. But I was in tears because I didn't know anything about reading the instructions. My mom talked me through that, even though she didn't knit. She's very good at that. But then she was in a bookstore, and on the remainder table, totally on sale, was Elizabeth Zimmerman's Knitting Without Tears. So what more perfect book for the child in tears? It was the perfect book for me. Obviously, because she had that sort of plug and play attitude about designing where like take her percentage, throw whatever pattern stitch you want in here, make it up yourself. It was a perfect start for me.
And she was such a, you know, the voice of the beginnings of knitting and design, wasn't she? I mean, she was one of the real early.
Well, loads of people were designing knitwear before her and even published knitwear. But I feel like she sort of caused a revolution by doing it her way, by starting having things be circular and not all flat in pieces. And because she started, she influenced so many designers that are around now, it does seem like she was the first. But really, for at least 100 years before, there were published patterns in knitting.
I love the fact that you have been designing. I mean, when you look on Ravelry or the number of collections that you've done, I mean, there are so many designs and patterns, Nora. I mean, they're all beautiful. I love your use of texture and the way you use cables and baubles. Absolutely beautiful. Do you have a favorite collection ever?
Of course not. But you know, from looking at my books and my work over the years, that my love does really, really lie with texture, with surface texture and one color, smooth yarn, because it really shows off that surface texture. And of course, since I've written a whole book on cables and a whole book on twisted stitches, like, I did that because those were among my favorites. Like, I love making up new patterns. It's my favorite thing to do. Like, everything's a variation on something that came before, and that whole progression just gets me really excited. Anyway, that's my favorite thing.
And where does your inspiration come from? I know that you have talked in the past about biology and shapes and sort of the structure of nature and things like that. Do these things, are they the things that sort of will suddenly trigger an idea for an inspiration for a design?
Well, I really love it when I can indulge in that. Like, the first book I wrote, Knitting Nature, was all about patterns in nature. And so I could indulge in pattern stitches that really had to do with mathematical things like phylotaxis or fluid dynamics or shapes of bubbles, and then combine those with kind of things you actually can wear, with fashion that was happening at the time and shapes that made sense at the time and were hopefully kind of classic too. But I do like odder shapes, especially when we're talking about things like bubbles. And that means that maybe a whole sweater is made like a bubble formation, and it's not all about surface texture. But sometimes, of course, I'm designing like for a yarn company, and we need to sell yarn. So I can't be quite as esoteric or indulge in always having a biological thing to start me out, but sometimes it's just like a variation on a theme. That's when I'm happy, anyway, when I can make something up new. And of course, I've done plenty of things where I put other people's pattern stitches together, especially in my early years.
You talked about Philip Ball's book, Nature's Patterns, and how influential that was. And I guess
absolutely
that then spawned like the designs, hexagons and those sorts of things, wasn't there? There were lots of shapes. But was that stuff that, when you were studying biology and art, were those ideas popping up then? Or was it like you sort of retro-connected those?
Retro-connected them. And so this, when I wrote Knitting Nature and when I first saw the Philip Ball book in the bookstore, it's like my education and what I did for a living finally came together. And my mother knew she had not wasted her money. Well, she already knew that, actually, because I think anything you learn, like, pays off in the long run. But here it was where my biology degree and my knitting prowess like got together with that book. And I loved the Philip Ball book because he really broke it down into these different categories. And it was, his book is written for educated people, but you don't have to have a degree in biology. You just have to have an interest in the natural world and shapes. And it's a really wonderful book.
And he's done quite a few, like, subsequently, hasn't he? He's, like, drilled down into the subject quite a lot and kind of looked at shape and flow and patterns and stuff like that. With then your creations and your designs being inspired by that, presumably you've ended up drilling into similar directions as part of the creative process.
Well, I've found that there are some things that I can't seem to let go of. Like, I have designed so many things with, especially hexagons, some pentagons, but loads and loads of hexagons. They fit together so perfectly, you know, tile to make a flat shape. And I found I was thinking in hexagons, like, have to make a peplum? Let's make it out of hexagons or pentagons. Or once I started thinking in polygons, I just kept going. And the same thing happened with a few other things in that book too, where once I got going thinking about it, I just kept going. So it definitely was a starting point for me. Yeah.
And so once you were writing patterns, and you were writing patterns for yourself and for yarn companies, we were talking about Vogue Knitting. Obviously, now this is your third issue coming up. Is that right? Or fourth issue? Or more than that? Much more than that.
I would have to turn around and count the magazine. Did we just have the fifth one? Well, I've lost track, but I think it's fourth, or we're working on the fifth. And of course, we're just about to put the winter one to press. So I can't count in any case, like exactly where we are.
You did the retrospective, didn't you? Where there were, was it 40 of your designs were chosen from a list of about 120 that you'd submitted over the years?
Yeah, a few years ago. You're really well studied today. Good job, Jamie. Really good job. A few years ago, when Tricia Malcolm was still the editor-in-chief at Vogue Knitting, she proposed that we do a retrospective kind of book where we go through the designs that I've done in Vogue Knitting, which started in 1987, was the first one I had published. So we went through piles of, they're actually photocopies of all, because that was a way for us to organize our thoughts. On the phone, we talked through each one. Yes, this one, not this one, maybe this one. And we had to have like four phone calls like that, culling it down. And then we realized that we could only fit 40. So eventually it ended up with being 40 out of the over 120 that I had published in the magazine over that time period, over the like 35 years at the time. It was hard work.
Very hard to choose.
It was.
And I guess as well, there must have been sort of designs that you look at which you think that were really timeless, that you could put into any decade and sort of think, yeah, I know that really worked well in the 90s, but it's going to work just as well now.
Well, luckily, so some of those things are true no matter what, like a few of them were timeless no matter what. But then in the last 10 years, wearing oversize has become really comfortable again. Like, remember for a while, no one wanted oversize. They wanted everything to be fitted, especially if they were young and thin. Like, then they wanted everything to be fitted. And oversized drop shoulder didn't look as good for a while. And now it just feels like almost any shape is good, but especially oversized and drop shoulder is fine. So a lot of things from the 80s and 90s were really right on again because of that. And that made our job, well, harder because there were more to choose from, but easier because we could go way back.
It's so interesting, isn't it? When you look at the sort of knitwear fashions of the 80s and 90s that are really sort of coming up now, like the picture sweaters, you know, any amount of intarsia with lambs and trees and faces on. And those things are really fashionable again now.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah, because all those sort of vintage books that you go and look at have got these sort of like fantastic picture sweaters in them that, you know, people love.
So the picture itself, the photo, may look ridiculous because of what they're wearing and ridiculous poses and, well, even strange printing. Like, printing didn't used to be that great. But the sweater itself, like, is still in and great. Yeah.
Because in the, was it, I think it was the issue with Michelle Obama, which we'll talk about some more, but there were lots of Beatles in that issue.
Right.
And I think one of the particular jumpers had quite a lot of intarsia. Like, I remember looking at it and then being like, oh, it's one of those picture sweaters, but it's like a really cool contemporary one.
There were some tricks in that. So that whole thing, I love to theme the stories. And so that whole story was about Beatles, obviously. And some of the sweaters were intarsia. Like, there was one with a great big intarsia on the front. And then one of them was stranded work with duplicate stitch to add like more complication to the color. So there's really embroidery over everything in the shape of knitted stitches. And that might be the one you're thinking of because it looked the most complicated, but really it was the addition of a little bit of embroidery on top of this green and black stranded work.
Yeah. I love it when we get a bit of duplicate stitch because it's like the Venn diagram between what me and Marion know.
There
like,
you go.
Yay, come on. Yay. Duplicate stitch.
And actually, I love the fact that there's so much stitching that is going on to knitwear at the moment. You know, it's so fashionable to see people are embroidering their knitwear all over the place. It's wonderful because it just looks so pretty.
Well, Well, I think in the past, I know I hesitated to design things that had embroidery on it or anything complicated, anything that was going to be hard to explain, because you only had so much room in the magazine to explain something. You only have so much budget for the illustrations, for the embroidery. And now some of those things are still true to an extent, but then you can have a video on it. You can have pictures on a blog or on your website, and you can have a video of how to do something. And you can have people can do things that are much more complicated that you wouldn't dream of explaining before, or they wouldn't dream of doing, but now they can see it. They can see it being done.
Yes, absolutely. And also, I think we're sort of seeing a resurgence of people being sort of multi-crafters. So when I sort of look back and I think of my grandmother, I mean, she could do everything. She was a fantastic knitter. She was a crocheter. She was a sewer. She was a stitcher. She could do anything. That was quite common, that you could do all of these different crafts. And then I think we've sort of gone through a period of time where there were people who are very definitely just a knitter or very definitely just a stitcher. But I think now we're going through this resurgence of all the crafts coming together. And I love that. I love the fact that the crafts are coming together and there is more of a blurry line between them.
Yeah, which is great. I think originally, like, our grandmothers knew how to do all those things out of necessity, because ready-to-wear was just becoming a thing, and they had to know how to do all those things. And of course, they took pride in doing them well and doing fancy stitching, but the basics they needed to know. And then we're so proud of not having to do those things and being able to do men's work. And, you know, I had to make a really conscious decision that I was going to make a living out of something that was quote unquote women's work. And was I letting myself down? Because I have a degree in biology. I have a degree in sciences. I was really good in the sciences. And I really had to say, yes, this is okay. That it's okay. I'm not letting myself down. This is what I do best. This is what I love. But it was a conscious effort. I strayed a little there, but
No. That's brilliant. That's what we like, Laura. Stray away. Isn't it so interesting that yes, we are conscious of that. That is something to be really conscious of. And the fact that you actually had to make that deliberate sort of choice.
There are women of a certain age who still look down on handcrafts because it was so in their head that they didn't want to do that. They weren't going to be in that world.
You know,
the stories are so strong, aren't they?
It is. And I remember somebody saying to me not that long ago, actually, well, apparently knitting's really good for the brain because, you know, there's lots of counting. And I said, do you know what? I don't need an excuse to love knitting. I don't care about the maths. I don't care about the counting. I love knitting. And that's it. It's a beautiful craft. It's a great skill. And the numbers are really very... And it was so interesting that another woman had tried to validate knitting. Like, it's okay because it's got maths in it.
Did she not do it? Because that's not why it's good for your brain, I don't think. I think it has a lot more to do with meditation and repetition and other problems that you're solving and patterns that you're seeing along the way, but it has nothing to do with counting. No insult to whoever's listening.
No. But you are absolutely right. And that's at the point where I thought, why are you trying to validate something on the basis of, well, it's okay because it's got some traditional something.
Right. Why could it just be valid?
Why could it just be perfect as it is? Yeah. But Jamie, I mean, you have this now. You're a man doing what is perceived as being a woman's craft.
Yes.
Do you feel like that?
Do you know what's funny, though, is that, like, so I've been doing this. I've been running the Mr. X Stitch website since 2008. So I've been around a while now, and yet it's still a novelty. And, like, you know, I did a psychosocial studies degree. So it was like, you know, man's influence on society, society's influence on man. And it makes me laugh that now I spend a lot of my time just fighting a story that we've been told for, like, 250, 300 years about what men do and what women do. And you find yourself in those positions, but it's just stories, you know. So a lot of the time, if I ever talk to a man about doing needlework, I'm like, just be a needleworker. Like, try and disconnect from the gender debate if you can, so that you can get past it and move on and decide if it's the right thing for you. Because as you say, the beauty comes from the way it makes you feel inside, you know, the slowness and the meditation and stuff like that. And that's not a gender discourse. That's just a human being experience.
Yeah.
So I still use my novelty. If people still think it's funny that I'm a guy doing needlework, then I use that to just stop and go, do you know what? I haven't been burnt in flames. I haven't been hit by lightning. It's good stuff to do, you know. And the fact that I'm still doing that after a decade is like, I don't know, the world turns slower than you hope sometimes, doesn't it?
Yep.
Can I do a bit of time travel for a second and go back to 1987 then? Because I'm kind of curious. 1987, you submitted your first pattern to Vogue Knitting at that point. How long had you been making patterns at that time?
10 years? 10?
Wow.
So I had my first piece published, maybe it's 1978 or 79. So nine years. And that is because my mother illustrated for the magazine and she brought it in. And so I had absolutely had an in. I mean, how would I even have known that the industry existed, I think, without mom? Yeah. Like, I would have known there was a magazine, but I wouldn't have known how to get my piece in it. So the first thing I ever had published was in Ladies Home Journal, Needle and Craft. That was their last issue ever. Put them out.
Yeah. I'm guessing you never had anything published in any of your dad's science fiction magazines. That would have been a neat trick.
No, but you can find drawings that kind of look like me.
That's close enough. So at the time, I mean, can you tell us what Vogue Knitting was like at that time?
Which time are we talking?
Sorry, like when you submit in a pattern to it, because obviously, you know, it's still relevant and it's had quite a roller coaster over the years. It must have been quite the prestige magazine at the time, right?
So it was 5 years in because they actually had restarted. We count our anniversary from 1982. Vogue Knitting actually was printed before that by Condé Nast in, I think, 40s, 50s, and 60s. I'm not sure exactly when it started. There was a first incarnation of it. And then it wasn't published for, I think, about 20 years. And then our founder was friends with one of the Condé Nast founders and got the license for the name and decided to start the magazine up again. So 5 years later, it was like the magazine to have something in. It was really beautiful. The photography was beautiful. The instructions were wonderful. It was the magazine.
Because the thing is I don't like, I'm pretty ignorant to this and I hold my hands up. I haven't ever looked at an issue of Vogue Knitting, but I've always been fascinated by the fact that there is a Vogue Knitting because I don't think there's like a Vogue embroidery or, a, you know, it's a very interesting that of all the sister publications.
I think it was a lucky accident. There are Vogue patterns, however, Vogue sewing patterns. Well, those started earlier too. But I think they continued all the way through.
I was going to say, and then, so when you submitted that pattern, were you then like, yeah, I could do that. I'll have a crack. Like, because it must be quite the feat upon reflection to find yourself in the editorial position then.
Well, it's many years that happened before I got here. I was really happy to have that in Vogue Knitting. I knew I could write the instructions. I had written instructions before. It had other things published for yarn companies. I was really happy to get my foot in the door there at Vogue, though. And then that continued for years. And meanwhile, I not only freelanced for loads of yarn companies and worked for other magazines, because everything was freelance, just selling a piece. All the rights to that piece were gone. That was it. Like, sell, gone, sell, gone. Then I also became the design director at Reynolds Yarn, which it was JCA, right. Johnson Creative Arts, but it was Reynolds and Unger and Adrian Vittadini Yarns were all under one bundle. And later at Barocco Yarns, I was the design director. So I got a lot of experience both of those places about photography and publishing patterns and getting a look you want. And so
all the while still maintaining, you know, still providing for Vogue at the same time, it's still being a constant thread all the way through.
When I worked for those companies, then it really was great for the company for me to provide something. At that point, if I was working at Reynolds, whatever piece I did for Vogue was in Reynolds Yarn. And if I was working for Barocco, then of course I did it under with Barocco Yarns. But then I learned so much doing those things that I had most of the skills needed to be the editor in chief. That's why they asked me. Yeah.
I mean, it's such an incredible position to be in, but we have to find out about Michelle Obama. How on earth did that
come
about?
Totally lucked into it, fell into it. the young reporter, Shayna Rose, came to us and said she'd like to do some kind of an article. She had over, since she was six, she had interviewed a lot of celebrities, and she also was a new knitter and had done some other knitting things, and she wanted to combine those two. And we're the ones, my staff said, well, if you can do someone like Michelle Obama, then yeah, go for it. So we didn't know how to get to Michelle Obama, how to interview her at it. But I think the magic combination was that Shayna was a new knitter and that she was only 14. And that really, I think, must have spoken to Michelle Obama. So everything was done through Shayna and her mom. And we had contact with the team, but I never got, I mean, it would have been amazing, such a dream come true to have met Michelle, but that didn't happen. We're just so thrilled that she did the interview and that there's a video up on the Vogue website with her answering Shayna's questions. And I was so impressed by the things, like she had all the lingo down, like frogging things. And I don't know if she used the word tink, but she had a lot of that down and she was fixing things with crochet hooks. And she had just learned during the pandemic, like less than a year before. So it was very impressive.
So good, isn't it? That's just fantastic. I think she must have really inspired so many people as well. And it gave knitting such kudos. People, you could see people thinking about it. If Michelle Obama knits, wow, I'm gonna knit.
People don't realize that intelligent women knit. Like some people have this picture of like just dumb little women are sitting there knitting, and the opposite is true. Like the most well-educated minds that just have to keep going all the time have to have knitting in their hands, because that keeps them a little bit settled and gives their minds something to do. And I think that Mrs. Obama fits right in that category.
Hey, Ralph, how are you?
Hello, love. I'm doing very well, thanks.
You're looking particularly well. What's the secret?
Well, I like to go for a good walk every day. I take my three poodles out down the field, observing the majesty of nature and understanding how magnificent life can be. And I listen to the Lovecraft Show at the same time.
But how do you know that there's a new episode coming?
Well, I've got a sophisticated system of pigeons that fly around, and somebody up in Skegness tells me they send me a postcard attached to a pigeon. Someone said you can just subscribe using your favourite podcasting app, but, you know, I've got pigeons, didn't I? So.
Well, I think you'll probably find it easier to subscribe, and even better, you could leave a review. You could tell Marion and Jamie what you think.
That'd be amazing, because what I do is I say, on the postcard from the pigeon, I say, that was great. And I send it back to my mate in Skegness, but I'm not convinced they do anything with it. So do it online is what you're saying.
Yeah, just go onto your favourite podcast platform, like and subscribe, and then just send us a message at show@lovecrafts.com and tell us all your thoughts.
No pigeons were harmed in the production of this soundbite.
Is there a difference between you as a designer and an author, because obviously you've published several books of your own work and stuff like that, and then you as a designer, but like an editor in chief? Because like, so, you know, I produce a magazine and I have a themed issue and I invite designers to respond to the theme, and I'm very much in the lap of the gods as to what they produce within that theme. And then it's kind of trying to fit it all together smoothly and stuff like that. Is that a similar approach you have to take? Because I guess you've got a direction you want the thing to go in, but it's, again, also, I guess, in the lap of the gods to some extent.
Exactly. So your question started out being like the difference between being an author and that.
Yeah. Because with an author, you can do whatever you like, can't you? But with being an editor, you can do some of what you like.
But it starts out about the same. It starts out thinking of a theme. Like I would have a theme for a whole book. The Cable Stitch source book is all these stitches I made up and then the patterns that go with it. And Knitting Nature was those patterns from nature and patterns that go with it. And of course, like I don't have that much control over what I design either. That's going to sound weird, but before you start designing, you don't really know what's going to come out, which the same is true with the book that came out in January, which is called Knit, Fold, Pleat, Repeat. Was based on thinking about origami mostly. And I didn't know, I had been saving up inspirational things for years, but I didn't know what sweaters were going to come out of that. But I had like a theme for each chapter. So the magazine is similar. I like to have three big themes to give designers to think about. And you're absolutely right. The things that come back do not necessarily fit in those themes. And maybe the themes get to have to be redone or rethought. I like my three themes to all also have an overarching theme. So that's allowed me a little less room changing themes. Like the one with the Beatles in it was the whole thing was about nature. So things needed to fit in there. But it starts out similar and then it does have to shift more because there are more personalities involved. And the submissions that come from the freelance designers, they didn't come from my brain. They came from someone else's brain. So of course you're right. It all shifts. But in my mind, it started out in a similar way with a theme that I set out.
Yeah. There's been plenty of times when I've done a magazine where I've been like, there's a midpoint and you're like, I don't know how this is going to go. I was saying it to someone before because I do all the layout and stuff myself. It's quite a small enterprise, I guess, just me. And then there's a point when I put everything in the right order. And at that point, it's hugely satisfying because then you're like, somehow I've managed to make this make sense, you know. But there's always that bit where you just throw the idea out in the air and then you're just like, okay, universe, please smile on me.
When you throw servant. That idea out or that theme out, you really don't know what the finished magazine is going to be like. But I learned a long time ago not to try to control that. Like, you have to have a structure, like the theme and the overarching theme, and then you get articles that work with that. But to try to control what exactly what's in the magazine and how it's photographed, and you have to let things happen. You have to let people do what they do best. So let other designers do what they do best. Let the photographer do what he does the best, the stylist who picks the clothes for it. So of course there's a lot of communication, but it doesn't end up looking like what I might have pictured. And a lot of times it ends up better than what I would have pictured because it's someone else's work in there. And then of course the art director, it goes in there and there's a lot of personality there that switches it again and again, usually for better, that the whole thing is lifted. And that's how I feel about all of the books I've done. Like, I was proud of my designs, but the photographers and the art direction and the editor, like, just brought everything up to something really wonderful that I can't take total credit for and that I had not imagined beforehand.
It's a bit bonkers, isn't it? Because sometimes you can't see the thing and then somebody comes along and they make a little tweak and you're like, how did I not see the thing that they've just done, isn't it? Just a simple solution sometimes that makes everything like float like a butterfly.
It's easy to have tunnel vision.
Mm.
You know, I talk about letting go and let everybody do their thing, but it's still hard to not have like a tunnel vision and not see that this other thing is good. Like, I have to purposefully relax about that.
So obviously you have an issue coming out and you have an issue ahead that you're also planning for and stuff like that. Are you still able to keep track of your own creative process? Because presumably you're still making your own patterns and all those sorts of things.
Okay. So in theory, I am able to do other work. In practice, right. I do not have the energy. So like right now I'm designing a few things for the spring 23 issue, because that's the one that we're in the design phase. Winter, we're almost finished with the art direction phase and the whole proofing and everything, crossing every T and dotting every I. So that'll go to press pretty soon. And meanwhile, the one that's on the market is the anniversary issue, the fall 22. So all three of those are in my head. And believe it or not, I have to send out a design call for fall 23, like in a couple weeks.
I mean, it's so exciting, isn't it? So like 40th anniversary issue and being in fall, perfect timing because that's where we love our knitwear most, you know, that sort of seasonal knitting where people get very excited about making for autumn, winter. At Lovecrafts, one of the things that is really important to us is inclusivity. And I know that, you know, now we expect pattern sizes to be fully inclusive, that we go, you know, from a 30, 32 inch up to 60. Or how is that factored in? Is that factored in for Vogue knitting patterns?
Absolutely. Since I became editor, the smallest set usually starts at bust 30 to fit bust 30. The sweater might be quite a bit larger, but to fit bust 30 and up to fit bust 60, the same range that you mentioned, because that's the standard now. And they didn't go that large before. So now we try to hit the whole gamut. Every once in a while, there'll be something that just geometrically cannot go up that high because it would be down to your knees. Or, I mean, that's a very unusual circumstance, but we try to cover the whole thing. And usually that's 11 sizes. Again, there might be a reason why there are fewer sizes, but it still fits that whole range. That was very important to me. In the 60s and 70s, everyone was supposed to be thin because our mothers told us we were supposed to be thin. Absolutely. They were supposed to be thin in the 50s. And my mom was one of the nicest people in the world, but this is something she could not get out of her head, and she weighed nothing. So, you know, you'll look better if you're thinner, you wear clothes better if you're thinner. Like, well, what about clothes being a tool for us? And it took a long time. You know those books by Trini and Susanna? They're British, right? The What Not to Wear. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
I really took those to heart. But since I was a teenager and I was not really overweight, but I thought I was, this whole issue has been very important to me. And I have weighed more in my life and less. Right now, I actually have lost weight in the last few years, and it turns out it's because I have diabetes. So it's not, you don't really want to lose weight that way.
No.
But that's what's happened. And don't worry, it's under control, and I know what's happening now. But that's why I am thinner now. But I was 40, 45 pounds heavier a few years ago, and I definitely know, and I'm 5 feet tall, right? So it doesn't take much to like look rounder. I definitely empathize with rounder figures.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that we hear a lot is, you know, and for myself as well, you know, being of the rounder variety, you know, you see a pattern that you absolutely love and you think, oh, that's the most beautiful sweater. And then you discover that it only goes up to 38, 40. And that really is just goes nowhere for anybody that's larger. And so I'm thrilled to bits that now the ranges are inclusive. And because you don't want to spend hours and hours and days and weeks and weeks and weeks making something that isn't going to fit you.
Right. And if you don't want to redesign it yourself either, you might as well have designed the thing in the first place. And of course, we've had a wider range of figures in the magazine. So you'll be happy to see in the winter issue that's going to come out soon, there's a model who is a US size 16, which
so that's about a UK 20, I suppose.
Yeah. And she, you know, she's a very average size, or maybe barely above average size, but she's not thin and she's absolutely gorgeous. And I love how she looks in the sweaters. She's not meant to look thin in them. She looks good in them.
Yeah, absolutely.
With the 40 year, I guess that's a retrospective again across Vogue, is it? Are you able to speak about what Vogue knitting has become, or like the almost like the classic themes that have emerged from looking back over all that time?
We didn't do too much of that. What I did was go to certain designers. Like one whole story is contrasting an older design with a newer one from each designer. So there are actually six designers that have both an older, like Mary Lynn Patrick, who's been in from the very beginning, has a design in this magazine that we republished because it was in the very first magazine. And then she did a new one that's only vaguely, I didn't want them to like do a new version of that pattern. We have that pattern. We sized it up the full range that we could. So it's rewritten and we put quite a bit of money into that, into the new sizing. And then Mary Lynn designed a new sweater that there's some vague resemblance because it has a yoke also, but the new one has a colorwork yoke and the old one is bobbles. But for me, it's fun to see what she did in 1982 and what she's doing now. And the same with the other story that's all ruby colored because it's the ruby anniversary. The five designers there did, we republished an old one and we resized it all. And then there's a new one that is only vaguely related in some way. And for some reason, they all end up being cardigans. So if you like cardigans, there's a, there's a lot of cardigans.
We love cardigans.
Yeah. And then we did some interviews with people like, what are you doing now? And did a little thing about Tricia Malcolm, who is moved on to being at Rowan, and like, what were her favorite covers? We tried to do fun things like that.
Is it satisfying that, I mean, in the digital era, when you were talking about, you know, the fact that now you can add tutorial videos and various other bits and pieces, there's still quite a nice prestige to the print format, right?
I think so. There's something special still. But you can get the digital version of the magazine. If you subscribe to the paper version, you get the digital version for free. Or you could just subscribe to the digital version. It's on an app, a Vogue knitting app. So obviously, all over the world, you can get that.
And also then Vogue Knitting Live,
oh, yeah,
the extension of the magazine in sort of great big nice yarn marketplaces. And with the...
Remember Gigi talking about Vogue Knitting Live? It's quite a seminal moment for her.
Yes. And when we, obviously with COVID, there were gaps. Has it been lovely to be back in person this year?
So first of all, I have very little to do with Vogue Knitting Live, but I will be there at the big one in New York. So it's really like separate people that run that part of it, with some interaction between the magazine, obviously, and the running of Live by Vogue Knitting, it's officially called now. There were gaps, but the interesting thing is that because it couldn't go live, like I definitely know this much, that's why the virtual version was born. And that turned out to be very popular and hit audiences that for various reasons couldn't have come to the live version, like couldn't travel, they were ill or didn't have the money. They could participate in classes and really enjoy it. So the whole period where we couldn't get together was really wonderful for that. And I don't know if that will continue. I personally hope that a certain amount of it will. Obviously, it won't be every month like it was. And then we've had a few smaller versions. Like I was at the Seattle Vogue Knitting Live in April, May, whenever that was. And it was fun to be together with people. But I feel like the whole world has shifted in ways that aren't all bad. Like it's really good that we discovered that these virtual classes are a wonderful way to go and still get together and can still be exciting. But it's definitely not holding people back for the February version. People are really excited for the New York Live.
That's very exciting. You know, a little bird told us actually that you also used to quite like singing.
Oh, that is true. What little bird told you that?
It's just in our clever little research. We found out that you liked singing. And also we thought you know, that you'd sung quite a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan.
I have sung. Well, I don't know who you talk to. I took voice classes in high school and I was in the choir. Which was like during the high school day. I was very proud of making it into the choir early. And so I'm kind of classically trained. I took some voice in college as well. And when I was in high school, I was in the chorus of our local Gilbert and Sullivan. So it was the Hudson Valley Gilbert and Sullivan Society. And we met in Poughkeepsie. And all the major characters were voice teachers from the area. We did Iolanthe, the Mikado. We do Pinafore. Now I'm trying to remember what. Gondoliers. We did. Gondoliers. I say that one already?
The thing is that, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan, it's hard to sing. That's not easy to sing.
No, it's a lot to learn.
Yeah, there's a lot to learn. So Jamie has created a special quiz in your honor.
Honor of your Gilbert and Sullivan. The quiz is called Gilbert or Gorn, right?
Okay.
Is the name I am about to unleash a character from a Gilbert and Sullivan musical, Or is it one of your knitwear designs?
Yeah, well, I'm just as likely to remember one as the other.
Yeah, so this is, and everyone's a winner on this. There's no, there's a right or wrong answer, but we're not point scoring or whatever. So we'll just see what happens. Right, I'm going to go for the first one. Is a greener. Is it a Gilbert or is it a Gawn?
I don't really know. So I'm going to say Gilbert because it doesn't sound familiar to me.
That is from the Barocco Nora Gawn, Volume 7, 2010.
So I named it. You know what that means? It means that I named it.
Yeah. You've got some good names. I'm going to take my hat off to you. Having spanned through pretty much every design you've got on Ravelry, I was very impressed.
So usually there's a theme to the name. Yeah. Anyway. Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to see. We'll see how we go. Next one then. Annabelle. I've probably pronounced that wrong. Annabelle, Gilbert or Gawn?
Gilbert.
Correct. Venetian gondolier speaking role from The Gondoliers, which premiered in 1889, everybody. There we go.
Oh, no. I just mixed up Iolanthe and The Gondoliers.
And The Gondoliers.
Very good. Okay, next one. Descartes. Descartes. Is it a Gilbert or is it a Gawn?
I probably named it something Descartes.
Congratulations. Woo! That was from Barocco number 319, Lindsay Geometry 2012. I wish if I knew anything really about knitting, I'd be able to describe what I was looking at as well.
But is the Descartes one, is that the one that's sort of quite feather and fan? That's sort of, I think I've made a Descartes. It's quite lacy.
I'm not sure. You said it was from the book Geometry, so which makes...
Yeah.
Oh, maybe there's a couple of Descartes.
Ooh. That's very
surely
possible.
The strap line is, I knit, therefore I am, on that one.
Oh, very funny.
Right, next one then. Orpheus. I'm doing these in alphabetical order, by the way, so there's no... Orpheus.
I don't think I named anything Orpheus, so I'm going to go Gilbert for that one too.
No? I'm so sorry. Barocco 349 Barocco Ultra Alpaca Chunky 2014. That one was
so
a good one because if this had been Shakespeare.
In 2014, is that actually mine? Probably is.
I mean, that's what it says on your Ravelry. So you've only got yourself to blame in that case. No, okay. And finally, I'm pleased to hear Phyllis. Phyllis, Gilbert or Gawn?
Gilbert.
Yeah, I mean, it could have gone either way, that one, but congratulations. An Arcadian Shepherdess and Worn in Chancery in Iolanthe, premiered in 1882. Congratulations, you are the winner of Gilbert or Gawn.
That's a fabulous quiz, Jamie. Well done. Bravo.
Really, you had some great names there as well. I could have gone on for hours choosing the names from yours and just seeing whether you'd remember them.
Usually a theme. Like, I remember one year there's a theme, women scientists. I can't remember any of the names, but except maybe Curie.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Nora, it's been fantastic to talk to you. It's been so interesting to find out and hear all about Vogue knitting and your knitting.
I mean, I was all ready to wax lyrical about how bees make hexagons and to talk about the beauty of nature. And I'm just going to say this just to get it out of my system, but apparently when bees make their beehives, they produce circular hives. But when they dry, they pop into hexagons because hexagons are the most efficient use of space to provide structure.
I didn't realize it popped into them, that they didn't build it that way, but it kind of makes sense. Yeah.
When it dries, it just kind of goes and then hits a hexagon or whatever.
If you had a bunch of circles and you mushed them together, they would naturally want to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I was trying to look up about how you could use fluid dynamics within knitwear, but that was beyond me. Like, I was looking at Philip Ball's books and he was talking about, you know, the way bubbles intersect and they kind of often form hexagons, and then you get the different types of chemistry where some lean towards cuboids, and then certain types of plants end up being kind of pentagonally symmetrical because it suits their needs and all those sorts of things.
Jamie, I think you did a lot of reading. You did a lot of reading with this book, didn't you?
I quite like the nerdiness of it. I love, you know, Fibonacci spirals within conch shells, and I know that inspired some of your designs as well.
We're going to have to get you that book if you don't own it already. Yeah.
I think so.
And then I was going to say about Romanesco broccoli, which is literally my favourite of all the vegetables. And anytime anybody is questioning whether there's a meaning to life, I like to throw a Romanesco broccoli at them and get them to figure it out for themselves.
Absolutely. A thing of great beauty.
It's so fractal. Yep.
Yeah,
it really is. When I was looking into you, and it was really interesting to see, like we said, the fact that you did biology and you did art, and then you came across this book, and then that influenced your work, and you can definitely see this kind of like link that you didn't even sort of know was coming. But I love the way it kind of influenced your work. And then knowing nothing about knitting, to then look at the way that you've used your twisted stitches and cables and all these sorts of things, which are largely abstract concepts to me. But I feel like I now know what a Nora Gorn design looks like. To be honest, I've really enjoyed diving into your work because I knew nothing and now I know a lot and I'm a very big fan. I hope you don't mind me saying.
Oh, thank you. And I'm honored that you did such great research. Yeah.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We just had a great time chatting to Nora. I hope you enjoyed that too.
Yeah, it was a really fascinating interview with her. I think it's nice to see someone so wise at the tiller of such an important knitted ship.
It is.
Would a knitted ship work, or would a knitted ship just slowly sink?
I think it might get a bit soggy.
You get my analogy, people. Hang on with me.
No, you're absolutely right. She is taking our craft world to a new audience, and that's fantastic.
If you like the show, be sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform, if you would be so kind. And if you haven't already subscribed to the show, I'll set Ralph on you.
See you next time, everybody. Bye.
Bye.